Make haste, my love, like a gazelle or a young stag upon the mountains of spice. Song of Songs, chapter 8, verse 14, the last verse of the book, Song of Songs. From God's Word, Jehovah's Word, the rendition of 2003 by yours truly. And this is, of course, the expression of the Shulamite maiden, because she's saying, make haste, my love, like a gazelle or a young stag, and stag being a word that refers to a male animal. Her love is a male, and she is a female. Excuse me. Okay, so that concludes the book of Song of Songs, a wonderful book, the eighth chapter of which is very, very beautiful in the expressions and the power of the love expressed there, as we saw when we read it. Abundant waters cannot extinguish love, and rivers cannot wash it away. Verse 7. And it even went as far as to say, if a man were to donate all the riches of his house for love, they surely would be despised. Love is something beyond money, way beyond money, far beyond. In fact, there's a scripture, I'm trying to think where it is now. Wings for itself like those of an eagle, money makes, and flies away when we pursue money. I think that's from Proverbs. Proverbs 23 and 5, in fact. Do not, in verse 4, toil to gain riches. Have you caused your eyes to glance at it when it is nothing? For without fail, it makes wings for itself like those of an eagle and flies away toward the heavens. Money flies away when you chase it. This is a very useful principle because it applies to all sorts of things, such as trying to chase down a shipment that got lost, or trying to worry about getting a refund on any number of things. It just says, guess what? Chasing money doesn't work. It's going to run away, fly away, in fact. Not run away. It doesn't even say that it runs away. It says that it flies away, like it's never going to be retrievable if it flies away, right? If money just ran away, you could get on, in the olden days, a horse and chase it, or you could get in your stagecoach, or, you know, in the modern day, you could get in a car and chase it. If it flies away, you'd have to get in a plane, first of all, but it would be a lot more difficult to chase if it's flying away, right? So that's a good illustration of the idea that money is nothing, right? It just vanishes very easily. So resuming our study now in the Ark of Urartu, we've got a very easy day today. We're going to relax. I'm going to talk about some things. Maybe we'll look at a video. I don't know what we're going to do. But I want you to do whatever you think you should do for your health today, whether it's take a rest or, you know, do some good exercise, or if you feel up to it. Exercise is for people who feel up to it. Or maybe you can, you know, drink some hydrogen water if you've got a hydrogen bottle. Or there's some vitamins I've been talking about recently, which I really think are important, vitamin K2, MK4, and MK7. Those two forms of the K2 vitamin are very beneficial, with vitamin D, calcium, magnesium, and boron all together. So that's a phenomenally powerful mix. So you can, if you eat dairy, you can use the dairy to get the calcium part of it. If there's enough calcium in the dairy you're eating, when I take a nutrition shake, I put raw chocolate powder and wheatgrass powder and the mix of raw vegetables from Garden of Life, which is a nutrition shake. Then I add the milk, and so by the time I get the milk in there, there's very little milk and very little calcium. So I take a single, maybe it's a couple hundred milligrams of calcium capsule with as a supplement with that. And then I'll always supplement milk with magnesium because you always need that. And boron always is beneficial with calcium and magnesium. And vitamin D is essential when you take the K2 vitamins. So all those things go together perfectly. But then there's another system of supplementation. Like there's the one single thing you can take is alpha lipoic acid, which is phenomenal for the regeneration of nerves. My finger is a lot, well, I don't know, you know, it's not perfect, but it's a lot better than it was. Where I burned it, really badly burned it, I'm still taking a lot of foods that I know are good for the regeneration of nerves, like alpha lipoic acid. I'm going to keep taking it though, because alpha lipoic acid is just a natural substance that your body uses in many beneficial ways. It even helps with weight loss. I think it's working in my case. I think already I don't have as much hunger all day long to eat and eat and eat, and I don't crave, you know, sugar as much. I think everything is changing now since I started alpha lipoic acid. Only a very short number of weeks ago I started that. I take three little tiny capsules a day. They're not the biggest size. All these things, of course, cost money, but then you might save money on food, too, in some cases. But the other whole system is vitamin E, glutathione, and N-acetyl-L-cysteine. N-acetyl-L-cysteine is a long word name for the substance, which is very, very beneficial. And it facilitates nerve regeneration also. I learned after. I've been taking it for a while, but I burned myself after I started taking N-acetylcysteine, which I take along with D-alpha-tocopherol vitamin E. That's the form of vitamin E I take, D-alpha-tocopherol. I take either 400 or I can double that maybe, but I'm taking 400 units of that, the D-alpha-tocopherol vitamin E with N-acetylcysteine. And I've gone to about, I think, 2 grams of N-acetylcysteine maximum per day, but only more like about 600 per capsule, and so I take 2 of them a day minimum. But the other thing I take is, besides the other supplements, which are for my eyes and things like that, forget that for now, but the only other thing that's taken with that is glutathione. I take with the vitamin E and the N-acetylcysteine, I take glutathione. Glutathione, I've been taking that for a long time, but I started taking it by itself, and then I learned about vitamin E, and then I learned about N-acetylcysteine, and they all work together with each other, those three. So glutathione, I take now a different form than I used to, which was the regular glutathione. I forget what it's called, the regular glutathione, but now I'm taking liposomal glutathione, much more expensive, but supposed to be a lot better. So it's about shortening or reducing, not shortening life, but reducing aging, right? Lengthening life, reducing aging, and maybe reversing aging. A lot of these things that are being looked into nowadays have to do with reversing aging. So I got off topic. Let's continue with our study. Probable behavior of the atomic clock. This graph in the Ark of Urartu, chapter 4, paragraph 5, at the beginning of this paragraph, is about the probable behavior of the speed of light. Let's close these other, some of them, tabs. This is a graph I got. I guess this is from the article I mentioned here. Mr. Barry Setterfield and Mr. Trevor Norman. Don't use the links below because they're all broken and they're all corrupt. Trying to mislead you. In 1987, the two mentioned men made a report on changing atomic constants, and specifically the mechanism of a changing speed of light was proposed as the means by which to adjust the atomic age, the atomic age of dated sediment. Because they thought, they obviously were Bible believers. That's why they were interested in this. But you see this, the probable behavior of the atomic clock. On the vertical axis, it's the speed of light. Logarithm of the speed of light. And that means it eventually, when you get down to today's speed of light, that will reach zero. Evidently, the logarithm being zero, it's no longer, you know, it just means like anything to the power of zero is just one. So when the speed of light logarithm becomes zero, the speed of light is what it is. Evidently, that's what they're trying to show here. So, and the horizontal axis is atomic time billions of years before present, with zero being the present day. Present day is 0 years before present, billions of years before present, a long time ago. 4 billion years ago on the extreme left of this graph. So these curves are all just different ways of proposing how the speed of light might have changed over time using those curves, right? They may represent, though they just are representing proposed behavior of the speed of light and the logarithm of the speed of light in this case. Okay, so excuse me. So the logarithm of the speed of light is what they're saying may have changed, and which means, of course, the speed of light's changed, is what they're saying, and that if that's the case, they're saying that affects all of these measured ages. How? It's not clear. From just that graph, how does the speed of light affect the rate of decay of radioactive elements? I mean, that's not explained. But this is what they are proposing. Their calculation dated the deluge to 3555 BCE. Interesting. Which puts it 273 years earlier than the 3282 BCE of the genealogy. Our date, 3282. But they date Methuselah's and Noah's births as earlier by 273 years exactly as well. So evidently they agree with our chronology relative to that flood date. Whereas their model is formed from light speed measurements in our modern day, which have been extrapolated back thousands of years. They didn't really make these measurements. These are just curves that they didn't measure these values because nobody was around millions of or billions of years ago. I hope my allergy will stop causing my nose to run in a minute here, but you see, because they extrapolate back many, many years, it's what they're showing there is an attempt to explain how a date of 720 million atomic years can be equivalent to, as far as the age of rocks goes, the date 3555 BCE is what they're saying, right? For the age of those rocks, based on a scientifically proposed mechanism, and that's the speed of light. They state that the speed of light has been falling and is reaching equilibrium presently after a rapid early plunge. Well, this is different, of course, from Einstein, who believed nothing more than that the speed of light was a constant in the universe. That was what Einstein believed, and out of that belief came all of the theory of relativity and everything. You know, that was a very important statement of Einstein, that the speed of light was constant. But of course, he wasn't talking about, you know, any change of the speed of light over time. Now, the speed of light, they say, has been falling and is reaching equilibrium presently after a rapid early plunge. I'm not sure that the graph showed a rapid early plunge. Did it? Let's see. According to these graphs, well, we don't know what the vertical scale is or anything. It's not shown. These are just very philosophical type curves. They don't really have a lot of science in them, although it's very important as far as what the scientific consequences would be, of course, if you impose curves like this on the speed of light. Now, they state that the speed of light has been falling. Okay, this has the effect of making, well, of course, it wouldn't be changing much now, is what they're saying. That's the main thing, is that the speed of light nowadays is constant, is what they're saying. This has the effect of making rocks present as much older. Their results agree. So in other words, rocks seem to date to millions of years ago. We've seen that's actually not true, right? But that's not even true for volcanic rocks. We saw that you can't date volcanic rocks that are like 10 years old. Even after a volcano erupts and they go and measure the date of the age of the rocks that have just been formed 10 years ago, they find they date to millions of years of age. The rocks appear to be millions of years old by the present methods of dating. So what they're saying here is not necessarily even required, right, in our understanding here, but is still worth looking at. Their results agree thus with a fourth millennium deluge date, which is what we have also, which we didn't use their method to get that. We just used the chronology, the Bible, and all the astronomy and the ways of determining that Jehovah provided for us to determine the chronology, which we called the genealogy, right? But I mean, we could have called it Jehovah's genealogy, whatever. We did call it the blessed genealogy because of Jehovah. But a fourth generation millennium date, that's the fourth millennium, 3555 and 3282, likewise. The fourth millennium, BCE. This refreshingly disagrees with the dates given by others for the deluge, as with that of Dr. Livingston, I presume. That's a play on words because of the words found in a certain story about Dr. Livingston, in which these words, Dr. Livingston, I presume, appeared. Once again, it appears science will undergo a revolution. And the reason I mentioned Dr. Livingston is because there is a scientist in the reference given here, which is not useful. Don't click on this, but you won't find the answer. You might be able to find it there, but it's not linked directly. A universal flood, 3000 BC, by Dr. David Livingston. So he dates at 3000 BC. So ours disagrees. Right, with Dr. Livingston, but so also does the date of the deluge given by Mr. Sutterfield and Mr. Norman here in 1987, the date of 3555. So that's why I said it refreshingly disagrees with the dates given by others, including Dr. Livingston. But 3000 BC and 3555 are both very reasonably close to 3282 BCE, which is our date. They're not that far away, right? I mean, not when you're talking about ancient time periods that nobody else successfully dates, but we believe our date is accurate, though. More so than virtually any other date. When it does, okay, first of all, once again, it appears science will undergo a revolution, this time where fundamental constants were once variables. Well, that's just the way it appears, but this may not be the case, that these fundamental variables changed over time, such as the speed of light. We don't know that. It's hard to prove. If all the facts were to fit that, if all the facts fit, then we would maybe want to believe it, but that's about all we can say. When it does undergo a revolution, science, that is, hopefully the genealogy will be confirmed, placing Nimrod 507 years, not 780 years after the deluge, which is the difference of 273 years between the date for the deluge of those two scientists and our date of 3282. 273 years, which means that Nimrod is that much less after the deluge in our chronology, since our deluge date is lower by that amount. That's all, though, for today. I know that is a very difficult, or what's the word? I don't know. I made more of that than I perhaps needed to, but it's very, just so that I could help as many people as possible understand it, I wanted to be covering that in detail. But it's a very short paragraph. It just says that there's another theory about atomic constants perhaps having changed over time, such as the radioactive clock of the decay rate of atoms. That may have changed. And the speed of light is what they proposed as causing that to change, if the speed of light were changing. But they didn't provide a mechanism as to why the speed of light were to have changed or anything like that. They didn't. It's not that sort of theory. It was just an idea they had. Okay. Now, I don't know. I told you about the Ron Wyatt website. There's this video, Ron Wyatt's Untold Story, Discovery of Mount Sinai. And I remember I published an article, and somewhere in that article I mentioned the untold story of somebody. And that seemed to gain some traction. A lot of people are using this expression now, untold story. And I feel like it's not like it's a copyright violation or anything. It's just like it's annoying when a certain phrase gets overused, right? It becomes trite and nobody appreciates it anymore. And they're certainly not going to appreciate who originated it either. You know, that's the other thing. Where I'm sure this idea of the untold story is not just originated in the modern day nowadays, but it's not just now when it was originated, but still, you know, it's not easy to come up with expressions that haven't been used recently. And then to see that people copy those expressions so readily, it's disappointing, I think, to say the least, right? That might be one of the reasons why we get so, you know, lacking in energy and tired, spiritually tired, is when people copy us without giving any credit to us. And they leave us feeling like all our effort was for nothing, because they're just going to copy it and not give us credit. But this video, Ron Wyatt's story about the discovery of Mount Sinai, as told by his former wife, who was married to him up until his death. It's quite an interesting video, to say the least. I don't know if we should watch it, but maybe we should, but it's just, how long is it? It's too long, obviously, to cover in one day, but, well, we could cover it barely in one day, I guess, but we wouldn't, there are so many other good videos, I don't want to take up our time with that one. Each person could watch it on their own if they so desire. So we don't need to take up that time. But the lead acid batteries, there's another video. What was it? I'm thinking here. That was the website. Oh, yeah. We talked about another video of his, too. Uh-oh. There we've got an ad. Yeah. Well, that's from a different channel where there are ads. This channel doesn't seem to have advertising on it. The RonWyatt.com channel on YouTube. It might be better because it doesn't have advertising. But if we can talk about... So just relax. Take some time if you want to. During your time off, if you're relaxing. And research where you might obtain some vitamin K2 or some of these other vitamins and supplements I've mentioned. You know, vitamin B12 is important for people, many of us who are vegetarians. If you don't eat beans, the vitamin K2 is important. Also, because you can't get vitamin B12, I should say, is important for those people because B12 is hard to get for vegetarians who don't eat beans, for example. Very few sources of B12 that aren't in meat. You know, meat is a source of B12. A lot of different meats, but okay. So what else? The lead acid batteries. Yeah, they're one of the most lead acid batteries in cars. They're the most disappointing part of owning a car, I would say, is the lead acid batteries. And the two most common causes of car breaking down, by far, the two most common causes of cars breaking down are batteries and tires. So if you don't get a flat tire and your car breaks down, almost in every case it's the battery, even though you can't, and you'll know because you can't start the car, right? But you know, there are other things that could cause a car not to start. And you can't always, it's not always immediately apparent that it's caused by the battery. Sometimes it's very difficult. There are many different things, symptoms that can be caused by the battery. So, but it's almost, in almost every case, it's the battery causing the problem. That you just need to get a new battery or... In some cases, the battery needs a good charging, but usually, battery's on its last legs if it's behaving like that. Or very often, typically, that's what's happening. Your battery will eventually need replacing anyway, and the fact that the battery needs replacing is sad because these lead-acid batteries, they have to go to recycling, and lead's very poisonous. It's just a very sad thing to have to give up on a lead-acid battery. I always feel that way every time. And when you get a new lead acid battery, you charge it up. You can do it using a power supply if you can limit the current, make sure it doesn't go above a certain level. But the main point is the temperature. You don't want the battery temperature to go up beyond, you know, to the point where it's unsafe. So, I mean, you want to keep the battery temperature as low as possible, actually, is the best practice. So you keep the current that's charging it as low as possible. Below 1 amp is the best. I mean, but you can go below 5 amps maybe is good, as long as the battery's not getting warm. But you might benefit by having a laser thermometer, which I have. I got for, I think, less than $20 on Amazon. And after that the price went way up, of course, but they do have these inexpensive laser thermometers. You just point the laser at something and it gives the temperature. that's how I'm taking the temperature of the battery, right? The casing of the, pointed at the outside casing of the battery. So I got some new equipment. Well, I got a new testing unit just because AGM batteries test differently. But even if you've got a regular battery tester that just is like $30-$40 tester that you can hook up to the, it's powered by the battery itself. You don't need batteries for the tester because it's powered by the 12 volt of the battery. If it's a good battery, you can use this tester to test it. If it has enough voltage, it'll test, right? It'll give you a measurement of what the cranking amps are, and it'll tell you. So, and it'll test the internal resistance, which is very important. The internal resistance, you know, should be just, you know, between maybe 3 and it can go as high as 10 or more milliamps, but it should be low in the sort of 3 milliamp, 5 milliamp, 8 milliamp, you know, somewhere in that range, depending on the battery technology. Mine is below 3 milliamps, I think. The brand new battery that's spiral wound AGM battery, different technology. It's a red top battery, but it's made by Optima. And I'm not sure how long it's going to last. I've given my battery a name like I do all my lead acid batteries. This new battery's Henry, and I've measured it after I charged it Henry as fully as I could before I first used it. I measured 2.83 milliohms with the new tester I got. But the old tester was saying 2.48 milliohms. You know, it was giving me a better number. And it gave me much higher cranking amps, whereas the new tester gave me... The new tester can do AGM batteries. You know, it's got the ability to do that. And they're both very inexpensive testers. But the older tester, other tester, which is... It tells me 1,200 cranking amps or something. Crazy. It's a 720 amp cold cranking amp battery. 720 is what it should be saying. So the new tester says 840 or something, 843 I think it was, which is closer to 720, and it's brand new, so that's probably closer to being correct. 800 instead of 720. As it gets older, that number can and should probably go down, and will go down, I would think. But when you charge a battery, you charge it until it reaches full charge, and then you put it on float, or you can charge it using float voltage all the way up. But as you're charging it, if you're using a power supply, you can check the charging current. But if you're not using a power supply, while you're charging it, you can just measure the voltage across the two terminals. Whatever voltage you're charging it with, if you know what that voltage is, that's what you want the battery to be at also. Before it's fully at the point when it's fully charged, it will reach that full voltage of the charger, but it shouldn't be more than 13.6 if you're doing a float voltage. So that's it for today. Mine's 13.2 volts that I'm charging at. But October 14th, 2024 of the Common Era. The time is 19:32 hours North American Eastern Daylight Time. I'm Ward Green. I love you very much. Thank you so much for listening and watching. And on my behalf, this is Liv Dusty and this is Cassie saying bye for now. That was paragraph 4-5 of the Ark of Urartu, the Orient Express.